This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Real life is scarier than anything we can dream of, and we dream such frightening things. Sci-fi and Scream.
Be afraid.
Be very afraid. On Joy 94.9.
And welcome to Sci-fi and Scream. My name is Sonia, and you're on Joy 94.9. In tonight's show, we will explore the music, the scores, and the soundtracks of the sci-fi and horror movies. Some of the ones we love, and others maybe we don't love as much. I'm joined again by special guest Ross Bryant. Hi, Ross.
Hi, Sonia.
Hi. But before we explore everything in the realm of the sounds of music, first we have to have a chat with Mr. Robert Lamal. Now, Robert was one of the organisers of last Saturday's Steam Pump. That was Saturday the 8th of May. And that was an event held here in Melbourne Central. So we'll just have a quick debriefing with Robert, and then we'll move on to the music scores of the horrors of the screen and the science fiction fantasies of our dreams. And this is only on Sci-Fi and Scream, and only on your LGBTIQ radio station, Joy 94.9. So welcome, Robert Lamal. Welcome to Joy again.
Oh, good evening, Sonia.
You're there? Good. I'm glad you're there. That's great. And just a few questions. How are you this evening, this Wednesday evening?
Feeling very relaxed, and I finally feel that I've left Saturday night somewhere behind us.
Okay, you're still buzzing a bit, I should imagine.
I am a little bit. I'm surprised at the success of the event. I suppose I shouldn't be.
No.
But I certainly enjoyed what I remember of it, because I was very, very busy.
Yeah, you looked pretty busy. If you hadn't been wearing that amazing top hat, I probably wouldn't have been able to, you know, seek you out from the crowd, quite frankly. Well, I think you had the tallest hat, I would reckon.
It was one of the taller top hats, and I think I'll be going back to a derby next time, but I'll wear something brighter if we do it again, that's for sure.
Now, tell us about Steam Pump. It was a steampunk convention, would you say? That happened last Saturday. Can you tell us a little bit about that gathering?
It was an exhibition, literally a subterranean exhibition held at the Donkey Wheelhouse, which is a fantastic space on Bourke Street. And we were absolutely blessed by having a whole bunch of exhibitors, even one fellow by the name of Don, who came down from Sydney, along with Mad Uncle and Dr. Insectus, that's Romy, and a few other people also as well. And and we were just really lucky. We had a lot of people put in bare knuckle boxing, a little bit of magic as well near the end of the night, and a fantastic tea room. Plus we had our own in-house DJ. And
yes, Miss Omega, that's right.
Yes.
Yeah, excellent. We've spoken to you before on Sci-Fi and Scream a few months ago. I think it was in January, when it was extremely hot and steamy, and it was quite a change to see people dressed in their lovely Victorian-style gear, and quite frankly, the weather suited it, don't you think?
Oh, the weather was perfect for wearing a waistcoat and, something
exactly.
More than that, especially if you're a lady with multiple layers. But
yes.
Some ladies very kindly decided not to wear a great deal, which I'm certainly not going to have an issue with.
And me neither. Those corsets were amazing.
There were some very nice days in corsets, that's for sure.
So how successful was the night? Because I didn't hang around till too late, but it looked like it was, getting pretty full.
Well, we think we had around about 140 people.
Right.
And I mean that's pretty much what we expected. We had people arriving before 6:30, which surprised me greatly. And we didn't have any issues at all. So we had about the right number of people, and we certainly had the right crowd. We had absolutely no issues with behaviour at all. Everyone was in a fantastic mood.
Yep.
So as far as that goes, I definitely judge it as a success. A lot of people ask me when the next one will be, so that's probably
a sign. That's a good sign indeed.
Yeah.
And I managed to get some recorded interviews with three of the Steam Pumper participants at that event. Mad Uncle Cliff, as you mentioned before, with his contraptions and inventions and devices, as he called them. I met Miss Alexandra with her Clockwork Butterfly costumery or clothing creations, Andrew Bandon with his time machines and artifacts, as he creatively called them. I'll play those interviews in a later program here on Sci-Fi and Scream. Tell us about those people. Like, they were the big three, weren't they, really?
They were. There were a lot of other people as well. I mean, they're probably the more prominent three. As far as Alex goes from Clockwork Butterfly, she's actually running an event in October.
Yeah, she talked about that at Formbury Theatre. Is that right?
Yes. So, well, if you've already... Yes, on the 9th of October. So if you
9th of October.
As part of the interview, that would be great, because I'd love people to support her doing that.
Yeah, fantastic. And I believe it's... Saturday the 9th, a steampunk extravaganza. I've got the flyer here. So with performances by Serena Del Fuego and Fildenstar. Now, Serena performed at Steampunk too, didn't she?
She did. She did an absolutely fantastic, fantastic job. You know, creatively losing several layers of clothing in quite an artistic and well organised fashion. Unfortunately, I didn't get to see much of it.
You were way too busy.
Crowd. Yeah. Yes, and there are a lot of other taller individuals who were enjoying the show. So I'd certainly like to see her perform again. That's for sure.
Cool.
I'm still working through it, and I'm looking at all the pictures on Facebook. We had quite a few really good...
Oh, I'll have to look that up.
Yeah, please check out Facebook. Yeah. And we've had our in-house photographer, Josh Button, also using the room that we provided for in the studio, taking photos of participants as well.
Mm. So tell us a little bit, just briefly, a bit more about the steam, in case people aren't aware of what steampunk is.
Okay, steampunk is, some people say, neo-Victorian. It's a little bit as if you imagined, or the way that perhaps Victorians, say in the 1880s or 1870s or even before, might have imagined the future. So if you read Jules Verne, you know, it's quite a common, well, easily accessed writer, it's looking at the future from a past perspective. And a lot of people say, imagine that the internal combustion engine wasn't developed, so you're still using steam. You do have some access to electricity. It's very retro. A lot of people view it as a kind of escapism or alternative reality, or a time perhaps when there were possibilities and we didn't have to worry about, you know, global warming and serious amounts of pollution, and life was a little bit more sedate, and certainly manners were more prominent. Now, actually, I noticed that on the evening.
It was refreshing.
Yeah, except for the caning that someone handed out later in the evening, but I don't think you were there to see that, which is probably a wise thing anyway.
Oh.
Mm.
Okay.
There are photos that on Facebook.
Punishment. All right. And so what is up next for you, Robert, now that you're coming down a bit? What are the plans? Any future steam pumping or...
We are looking at it. We don't want to run one, obviously, in October, because we don't want to, sort of wear people out. I think Clockwork Butterfly, Alex's extravaganza in October is great. There is also rumour of a New Year's Eve steampunk event called Uchronia.
Oh, okay.
Which I really, really hope is on. It was on 2 years ago at Trades Hall, and it was fantastic. In fact, a lot of what they did was an inspiration for what I wanted and what people helped us do at Steampump itself. We may run another one in a couple of months. That depends on if people want to do it, and I certainly don't want to make it too regular. I think once or maybe twice a year is plenty. As
it satiates the appetite and also saves you from having a nervous breakdown.
Yeah, it would,
kind of that.
I don't need one of those in my life.
Don't think they had them so much in the 19th century. Didn't they have, like, hysteria, such matters?
For young ladies.
Young ladies.
Yes.
But the hysterium.
For young men, generally, you had more moral fibre and you'd probably just take to drink or opiates. But
that's right. And snuff.
One of those. And snuff.
People were taking snuff, weren't they?
Yeah, well, we took some snuff, yes. Well, Glassjaw War, one of our bare-knuckle boxers, or he was actually named the fop with a mop, which I think he's going to deal with someone when he finds out who they were who named him that.
Goodness. We do not condone violence on the show.
No, we don't condone violence. He would probably just give them a very stern talking to, and he'll look very seriously at them and probably never give them snuff ever again, which will probably be punishment in itself. But he was kind enough to be handing it out, and that's it's wonderful stuff, though. The next day, getting it all out of your nostrils is not so pleasant.
Not so pleasant. Now, where can people find your website address or blog, if you have one available?
If they're looking for the website, and my wife Jen has done a wonderful job at linking lots of photos. So if a photographer took photos, go to our website, which is www.steampump, all one word, the word steam and the word pump all together, steampump.com.au. Go to the gallery page.
And
you will find, I don't know, more photos than you could ever hope to see.
Exactly.
Possibly.
That's excellent. Well, Monsieur Lamal, Robert, thank you so much for speaking to us tonight on Sci-Fi and Scream. And we wish you all the best for the future and looking forward to seeing the Clockwork Butterfly extravaganza with those amazing corset tree delights.
And all the other
things. I'm convinced now. And all the other things, yeah. And Sectus was awesome too. Like, it was very interesting.
Romy's setup was beautiful as well. Yeah. In fact, everyone, we don't have time, but so many people put in, and hopefully we'll have another event at some point. So, if we do, Sonia, we'll get in touch and get in case anyone's interested.
That's great. You've been listening to Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9 with Sonia and special guest on the telephone machine, Mr. Robert Lamal, organiser and phrenologist of Steampump Melbourne 2010. That was on last Saturday the 8th, only on Sci-Fi and Scream and only on Joy 94.9. And welcome to Sci-Fi and Scream, Joy 94.9 with Ross and Sonia. And that was a little chat we had with organiser of Steampump for 2010, May 8th, and that was Robert Lamal. Thank you, Robert. Thanks for letting us have a chat and a debrief about the event, because it was just awesome. Now, that was actually Forbidden Planet, and that was from 1956, so that's part of our soundtrack exploration tonight. Now, that soundtrack music was done with electronic effects by Louis and Bebe Baron, and the film was directed by Fred Wilcox back in 56 and starred Walter Pidgeon and Anne Francis and Leslie, a very young Leslie Nielsen. And the characters and setting were inspired by Shakespeare's The Tempest, apparently. The plots, of course, have many similarities. Now, the film features a number of Oscar-nominated special effects, including groundbreaking use of an all-electronic music score and the first screen appearance of both Robbie the Robot and the C-57D flying saucer Starship, which is pretty awesome. Now, the movie's innovative electronic music score was credited as Electronic Tonalities, partly to avoid having to pay movie industry music guild fees. And it was composed by Louis and Bebe Baron. Now, MGM producer Dori Shari discovered the couple quite by chance at a beatnik nightclub in Greenwich Village while on a family Christmas visit to New York City. Now, that's a pretty beatnik, far-out Christmas for a family back in the day. Now, Shari hired them on the spot to compose the film music score with a theremin. But they didn't actually use the theremin in the end, in Forbidden Planet. Now, the soundtrack was preceded by a Moog synthesizer, and that's quite interesting. That wasn't used till 1964, so that's, just about a decade later. So, Louis and Bebe Baron did not belong to the Musicians' Union. Their work was not considered for an Academy Award, of all things, in either the soundtrack or special effects category. Curiously, MGM avoided producing a soundtrack album when the film was first released. However, film composer and conductor David Rose released a 45 single of his original main title theme when he recorded at the MGM studios back in Culver City in March of 56. This theme had been discarded when Rose, who had originally been contracted to compose the film's music score in 1955, was discharged. Now, the innovative soundtrack was finally released on a vinyl LP album for the Barons for their first 20th anniversary in 1976. So, there you go. What did you think of that, Ross?
It's really interesting. Yeah, I can remember that very well, those electric sounds. And
yeah, they're just awesome. And so modern, like even when you hear the clarity of the sound now, it's pretty amazing, back then that they had that technology, or they sort of just invented it, I guess, as they were going. And to start with, we actually played the musical score to Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which came out back in 1977. Music was by John Williams, and it was played by the Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra. And the film soundtrack was actually
nominated for Best Original Score at the Academy Awards in 78 and the Golden Globes and BAFTAs, but it lost both those awards to Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope, which was also scored by John Williams. So he didn't really miss out, I don't think. What do you think, Ross? He still came away with an Oscar.
Yeah.
Might not have been Close Encounters, but it was the other one. The space opera, as they call it, Star Wars, although some people would disagree that it's not a space opera at all. Mm. Now, what's some of the music you want to listen to tonight? Because you have got a couple there you were interested in looking at.
Well, I'll be taking us to the Europe end of things, because a lot of my soundtracks are by Goblin and Claudio Simonetti from Dario Argento's film Tenebrae and Suspiria.
Yes. Cool. So, Tenebrae.
Mm.
We should probably play that.
Yeah, I think that sounds like a good idea.
Yeah. Excellent. All right, you're listening to Sonia and Ross on A Sci-Fi and Squeam. Stay tuned after this. That was incredible. Tell us about Goblin. Now, they're the people that produce that wonderful music. Am I right?
That's right.
Yeah. Cool.
It's a progressive rock band from Italy.
Mm-hmm. You have mentioned them a couple of weeks ago.
That's right. The lineup did vary a little throughout their life, but they've basically stayed loyal to Dario Argento throughout his film career. And Tenebrae and Suspiria and Phenomena are probably the three most popular soundtracks to their Dario Argento films.
Why do you think they're the most popular?
They use a lot of synthesizers and Moog and rock.
I love Moog.
Just, yeah.
Puts you in the Moog. So, Ross, they're the legendary Goblin.
That's right.
Indeed. And I've heard a lot about them through you. Probably not through anyone else I know on the earth. And they were originally called Cherry Five or something. Influenced by Genesis, I read somewhere, which is interesting. And the progressive group from the 70s, King Crimson. And they're like psychedelic kind of weird rock.
Yeah,
that
doesn't surprise me. Yeah.
Their early work, according to what I read, was spawned on one eponymous progressive rock record, apparently, with some by a guy called Giorgio Gaslini. Mm. Apparently he left the film that Argento was working on, Profondo Rosso, after he fell out with him. And then they changed their name to Goblin. But like you were saying, they've had a bit of a reshuffle in their lineup over the years.
That's right. Yeah.
Are they still around?
Well,
do they work much now? Or?
Well, as far as I know, they only get together every now and then for an Argento film. And the last thing that they did was Not Il Sonno, which is the English title is Sleepless.
Not Sleepless in Seattle.
No, very, very different. And this was, we talked about a horrific flute murder scene a couple of shows ago that really, really lasts in your memory. Yeah, very psychological.
I couldn't sleep properly after that.
Yeah.
No, I'm lying.
Oh.
I can't sleep properly anyway.
Evidently. No, but that's the way his films have affected me, especially Suspiria. Totally couldn't sleep. And it's so rare that I find a horror film that affects me that way. And, the soundtrack definitely has a big part to play in these films' creepiness. Some of it is really psychedelic. Some of it is kind of cheesy and has a bit of a Casio feel. Ooh. And sometimes a bit of a dated Euro rock sound.
Ooh, so like Eurovision about like 20 years ago or something. Maybe not
something
quite
like
as
that.
Bad as that. We love Eurovision, by the way. We do.
I love everything Euro.
Euro, sorry.
You're very European in your own way.
Thank you. I think. Not sure.
Well, if you've ever seen The Hunger, I mean, it's a kind of a thing that she describes the the female vampire character as being European.
Catherine Deneuve.
That's right, yeah. Because she's
Susan Sarandon and her nipples. I got to say that.
Racy?
I don't know what they were doing. But anyway. No, what are we going to play next? I've got some Shining by Luca Lombardi. Now, Luca Lombardi, this is his version. However, it was done by one of your favourites, Ross.
Oh.
Wendy Carlos, original horror.
We love Wendy Carlos.
Clockwork Orange.
Yeah, amazing.
Awesome.
Amazing.
She did there. I've got the soundtrack. You got it?
Oh, yeah, I've got that too.
Of course you have.
It's one that we have in common.
I
got mine.
I could have played that, but I think I've played it before. So, yeah, we played it together on New Year's Eve.
Oh, that's right.
Do you remember that back in the old days?
Well, I have something else from Goblin if you want to hear that later in the show.
Yeah, we'll have that after this.
Sounds great.
But what's the one you want to play later in the show?
Well, I was planning on playing another one from Tenebrae, but I think maybe this one from Creepers I'd like to play, actually. A really good one that we haven't heard before on this show.
Creepers?
Very off the planet. It's a bit rock, a bit sci-fi. And it's even got a bit of opera singing in it, believe it or not.
Sounds like it's up our alley.
Definitely.
You're listening to Sonia and Ross on Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9. Well, there you go. The Shining. Now, that was the Luca Lombardi version of the original beginning of the film, where the car travels through the Rocky Mountains to the scary hotel where Jack Nicholson's character, Johnny, well, he's not Johnny, actually, is set to write his novel with Shelley Duvall and son in tow. And the film features in the original soundtrack, a brief electronic score by Wendy Carlos, as we mentioned before, and Rachel Elkind, who also worked with Wendy on a number of things. The main title is actually based on Hector Berlioz's interpretation of Adieu's Aria, which was used in his Symphonie Fantastique from the 19th century, and there are pieces of modernist music in there too. The soundtrack LP was taken off the market due to licensing issues and has never appeared as a legitimate compact disc release, and that's why I've never seen it. Have you ever seen it as a compact disc?
No, never.
And that's why. For the film itself, pieces were actually overdubbed, beg your pardon, on top of one another. So it really gives that layers. But that particular version is a lot cleaner and sharper. And I won't say muddy, but certainly a lot easier to listen to. I've seen the film and its original 35mm on the big screen. And the soundtrack was a bit rough, but probably needs to be remastered. Hopefully that will happen in the near future as we get closer to the to its birthday. That would be great. And just for a little bit of trivia there, the opening sequences as the car drives through the Rocky Mountains are where, incidentally, that footage was used in Kubrick's earlier film, the masterpiece 2001 A Space Odyssey. That was used back in 68. Obviously, that was reimagined totally. So when you get those very far out, almost trippy-like, saturated colour, chrome scapes, you know, spacescapes or inner spacescapes, they're actually those pieces of footage from the Rocky Mountains aerial shots.
Wow.
And then they're used later, and he used that stock and then just overlapped it with some new footage of a car going through the mountain road.
Oh, wow.
Trivia time.
Who would have thought?
No, you've got something there. Suspiria, I believe.
That's right.
And you're listening to Sonia and Ross on Joy 94.9. Well, I was afraid of that one. Suspiria. That was Marcos.
Marcos.
Tell us about that vocoder-like sound with the voice. That was very thrilling for
me. What they do is they get the sound of an electric guitar and they put it into the memory bank of the keyboard. Ooh. And they use a voice to control it.
And when was this done, though? This is like 1980-something.
1976.
Good grief.
Yeah.
That's madness.
Still.
Hello.
Yeah. It's a very psychedelic soundtrack. It's insane.
It certainly is. Now we've got an SMS message. You're going to read that one.
Okay. I've got a SMS from Carl. And Carl, in response to our SMS topic about what soundtracks do you like and why, he says, I like the Blade Runner soundtrack. It's soothing.
Yeah,
great to put on as you drift off to sleep at night. I can relate,
Carl.
That's
true. Yep. It's beautiful, actually. Mm. It reminds me of rain, because there's a lot of rain in the soundtrack and in the film, particularly at the end. Mm. And hello, the theme from Halloween. This is another SMS. It gets me in the mood for stalking. I don't know about that one.
It's very
from your anonymous stalker. Oh, thank you, anonymous stalker.
Yeah, thank you, anonymous.
I think he needs a bit of a reality check.
The Halloween theme is very uplifting. Inspiring.
You think?
Yeah, definitely.
Especially for people who like William Shatner or something like that. You know,
put a bit
crazed.
Of pale blue paint on a William Shatner mask and, you know,
stretch it in the right places.
Oh, sorry. I thought
Stop
you were,
that.
I thought that was a metaphor. Sorry.
I'll give you a metaphor. Speaking of metaphor, we've got a little bit of this. This is actually David Cronenberg's masterpiece from back in 1983. And that was when David Cronenberg was still not quite in Hollywood, but he was in Canada still. And this is Videodrome. You're listening to none other than Sonia and Ross Now, that was Videodrome, music by Howard Shore. I'm amazed. And that was done back in 1983. It's a Canadian science fiction film, and it starred James Woods, Sonia Smits, and the younger Debbie Harry from Blondie. Set in Toronto during the early 80s, it follows the CEO of a small cable station who stumbles upon a broadcast signal featuring extreme violence and torture. He soon finds out that their signal actually causes damage to the brain, causing hallucinations. As he gets closer to discovering the origins of the signal, he gets sucked into a world of sadomasochistic sex, as you do, right-wing conspiracies, and bodily transformations. And as Philip Brophy describes it from his book 100 Modern Soundtracks, he has something very interesting to say about Videodrome. He basically says, "The streaming and cascading waves of morphed orchestration in Videodrome paint a sonic abstraction of the schizophrenic media being of the present." Goodness. Portrayed by Max Wren, which is James Woods, a journalist whose hunger for the shock of the new keeps him addicted not only to anything on topic, but simply to his own self-generating state of agitation and anxiety, ripe for piercing the slick skin of any repressive traits. Sounds fun. Including his own, Max's interior state is thus less of fixed temperament and more of fluid potential. His personality is symbolised by the aura of digital and analogue texture and contrast, connotating clinical precision and rounded modulations, respectively. Thank you, Philip Brophy. Now, he is an RMIT lecturer in various things of media and sound studies for film and soundtracks. Good on him. That's a good book, that, and that came out in 2004. What did you think of Videodrome?
I love that music.
That was awesome.
I haven't seen the film in a long time, but it brings back some very pleasant memories.
Very. Now you've got a track next, and then we're going to do some news.
Oh, good. That sounds good. This is a track that I'd like to dedicate to my sister, Rachel.
Oh, Rachel, good on you.
And I hope you enjoy it.
Yep.
It's from Goblin, another one.
Another one.
Talked about them cool. A little earlier.
Yep. And you're listening to Ross and Sonia on Sci-Fi and Squim, only on Joy 94.9.
Headlining tonight's sci-fi and horror news is the sad news that American science fiction and fantasy artist Frank Frazetta has died from a stroke on Monday the 10th of May 2010, aged 82 years. Mr. Frazetta, who had a history of strokes, had returned from a Mother's Day dinner with his family on Sunday night and fell ill. Emergency medical services were called and Mr. Frazetta was rushed to the hospital where he died. Noted for work in comic books, paperback book covers, paintings, posters, record album covers and other media. Back in December 2009, Sci-Fi and Squeam reported that the late artist's son, Alfonso Frank Frazetta, 52, known as Frank Jr., was arrested for attempting to steal approximately 90 paintings from the Frazetta Museum. After siblings Billy Frazetta, Holly Frazetta Taylor, and Heidi Graben filed a lawsuit against Frank Jr. in March 2010, claiming misappropriation of their father's work, which they said the artist had transferred to a company controlled by those three. The family issued a statement on April the 23rd, 2010, that said all of the litigation surrounding his family and his art has been resolved. All of Frank's children will now be working together as a team to promote his collection of images. Later, all theft and burglary charges were dropped by the rest of the Frazetta family. Frazetta will be remembered by many as a visual artist who inspired the gamer and anime art scenes for many decades, as well as fantasy animations. And Frazetta has influenced many artists within the genre of fantasy and science fiction, including Yuzuki Nakano, a lead artist for Nintendo's Legend of Zelda series. Frank Frazetta was an illustrator whose vivid colours and striking brushstrokes conjured up fantastic worlds of muscle-bound heroes fighting with broadswords and battle axes to defend helpless women from horrible beasts. His realistic renderings of otherworldly scenarios and barely-clad women made him the ideal candidate to illustrate the album covers for popular heavy metal albums. That was a report taken from the New York Times. And to Australian album cover aficionados, it was his artwork that graced Aussie band Wolf Mother's album cover called Wolf Mother. He also did the iconic movie poster for Roman Polanski's The Fearless Vampire Killers in 1967, starring Sharon Tate, of course, I like to mention that. I hope we will remember him and his individualistic work for many years to come. You can visit our Facebook site for more info and websites to look at regarding the late Frank Frazetta. For example, you can go to frazettaartgallery.com. And in other sci-fi and horror news, the Alien Queen jaw has been stolen from a museum in the UK. Someone has stolen a piece of the Alien Queen exhibit on display at the London Film Museum and they'd really like it back. The incident occurred last Wednesday. At the end of the day, a member of staff noticed that the inner jaw was missing from the 30-foot display. The inner jaw is famous from the films as the part that pushes forward as the alien creatures widen their jaws. The production model housed in the museum belongs to the museum owner, Jonathan Sands, and he has been in his personal collection since 1990, and naturally they would really like it back.
Wow, that's some brilliant sci-fi and Squeam news, and you've been listening to Ross say that. Excellent. Thank you, Ross, for that. And that was Videodrome we were playing before that. Actually, no, before that, before the news, we had some Suspiria.
Yeah.
Which you could hear in the background, actually.
Actually, it was Phenomena. It was the main theme.
Oh, what's the main theme called again?
Phenomena.
Yeah. I'm sorry. All right. Well, now for something a little bit different, and that is something that is coming up in the future soon, and that is Tron Legacy. Tron Legacy is going to be the big one, upcoming in 3D and IMAXs for 2010. I believe December the 17th is when it is due to be coming to us. So that will be very good. So we're looking forward to that, no doubt.
Would you like me to play another song from Tenebrae, perhaps?
Oh, yeah, let's go out with some Tenebrae. Why not?
Okay, here it is. It's called Silent Death, and it's anything but silent.
Sci-Fi and Squeam was synthesized and squashed into shape by Sonia, Albert and Kaz. For more information, visit our Facebook page, Sci-Fi and Squeam, or check out joy.org.au.
Thank you for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.